Thank you for joining us at the Roundtable.
Brought to you by Community Education Arts, a nonprofit organization based in Noblesville, Indiana.
I'm Alice Cavanaugh Scober, President of CE Arts.
And I'm Sarah E. Morin, Secretary of CE Arts. Let's sit down at the Roundtable.
So next up, let's look at structure and how the structure of all four of our books, what do they have in common, what are they different, what do we like about them, what do we don't like about them, how does the structure impact each novel, what do we think about that? Let's see, so commonalities, tell us what you think the structure, what have we identified as commonalities?
All four of them. And again, we're talking about Gone with the Wind, Jane Eyre, Dracula, Little Women. All of them are fairly straightforward timelines, thoughts, and dialogue all inform the characters' thoughts and feelings. And then why don't we take a moment and now let's talk about how they're all different.
Yeah, exactly. I had a note in here that might be in a... Let me look through my notes really quick. Oh, I don't know where it is. Oh, well, it doesn't matter. Do you want to start with Gone with the Wind? Should we start with that one? And you go first. Talk about... You go first.
Okay. First up is Gone with the Wind by Margaret Mitchell. It is written in 5 parts. It is third-person omniscient. It's mostly focused on one Scarlet's point of view, being Scarlett O'Hara.
Yeah, one character.
Again, your favorite character, is that what you said?
No, I said one character's point of view, which I think, like, Little Women does that too with Joe, but go ahead.
It's a straightforward timeline, as we mentioned before, and the thoughts and the dialogue all inform the character's thoughts and feelings.
Yeah.
And so the impact of the structure on the novel, that's one of the things that fascinated me the most. I've often heard Gone with the Wind referred to as a sweeping novel, even a sweeping epic.
Yeah.
And I think it absolutely feels sweeping. And I don't say that just because of the length.
Mm-hmm.
It's over 800 pages, so that alone makes it sweeping.
Yep.
But it is sweeping or epic because something life-changing is happening pretty much every chapter. You know, somebody is dying, someone is losing a home, something's burning, they're losing a war. Every single chapter has something happening. And so that's why, to me, I didn't feel like it dragged, really, at any point, except for the very beginning dragged a little bit for me, because I'm like, okay, 4 chapters in, are we going to go to this barbecue yet? But after that, the pace of it really worked. It truly was sweeping.
Yeah, that makes sense to me. I think that makes sense because for one thing, the time period that the book is set in, which is basically from the first shots of the Civil War through Reconstruction, I mean, talk about, you know, something happening every day or in every chapter, every moment. There's a lot going on in that time period. I would say on the linear structure, I really like that. I like to start at the beginning and go straight through to, you know, in consecutive sequence of events. That's easy for my brain to process. So I appreciate that. Now, there's a little bit towards the beginning of the book, and probably in those first 4 chapters you were talking about, that there's a lot of backstory about Scarlett's family history, her ancestry. So so in that regard, it's not completely straight timeline, but that's a style of a narrative device that works in this in this book. What I really appreciate about the narrative style of Margaret Mitchell's writing is that we, quote, see all, quote, end quote. You know, as the reader, we see everything. We see in the brains and hearts and souls of all these people, kind of in the moment, all the characters. We see them have thoughts that, oh man, if they just didn't see it that way, they would get along with someone. Like, Scarlet and Red are at cross purposes so much, it drives me crazy, because we get to see them be at cross purposes, like, behind the scenes. We're like the fly on the wall, right?
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. In their brains. That's gross. A fly on the wall in the brain. But but we get with the third-person omniscient narrator, it's almost like a historian's voice. We get a lot of detail throughout the book about the historical and cultural realities of the time that the story takes place that inform on what's going on geographically and within the characters' behaviors and thoughts. It's an in-the-moment context of certain scenes and action taking place, and I really like that. I enjoy that. Like I said, we get backstory about Scarlett's ancestral history in early chapters. That's kind of important because it helps us understand her character.
Yeah.
And the characters of her family members.
And I think also to understand what's lost.
Yes. Yes, that's true. That's a good point, often overlooked, but yeah. But we also get to see how the O'Haras are different from some of their neighbors. They're newbies, you know, they're recent. Gerald O'Hara is first generation immigrant in Clay County, Georgia, whereas like the Wilkeses and the Hamiltons have families been there way longer, you know. And so they're, you know, that difference is subtle, but it's in there, you know. The other plantation owners look down on Gerald O'Hara a little bit. Ellen, his wife, her family from Savannah, really looked down on him. And the backstory of their meeting and getting married and everything is fascinating because it really gives us a lot of insight into Scarlett's character as their firstborn child and everything. All of that helps us understand not only Scarlett and her family, but the Wilkeses, the Hamiltons, Ashley, Melanie, Charles, all the other people. And Margaret Mitchell does a really good job of continuing to do that kind of storytelling throughout the whole book. Every once in a while we get contextual overviews, if you will, about the history, what's going on in that time, and the culture of the time period, what is normal, what is socially acceptable, and what's not. She literally tells us that, you know, and about each character's thoughts and feelings. And some of that stuff that she tells us about what's appropriate, what's not appropriate in social situations at that time comes in characters' thoughts and feelings. Scarlett, a lot of times, she will be thinking, you know, that she can't do this or she can't do that, or you know, good girls or good women in the South don't do this or that, but she's thinking how ridiculous it is that she can't do what she needs to do to make money, to keep her family safe and all that kind of stuff. There's some very interesting passages like that where Margaret Mitchell is telling us what life was like in that time period, especially for women, especially white women, in this particular book. And you know, it's coming through a character's thoughts. So I think that's really interesting. It's a really interesting way for us to know the characters. And again, Scarlett and Rhett's relationship playing out through a lens that is so cross-purpose. We get to see it all happen. It's quite fascinating. I think it is also really interesting to remember a couple things. The book is basically about 10 years time. The story takes place in about 10 years time. Again, Civil War to the beginning-ish of Reconstruction. I think if I've got the dates right, I remember right, it's about 1861 to 1877. That was when Civil War and Reconstruction happened. And the book covers about 10 years of Scarlett's life within that time period. She is 16 years old at the beginning of this book. I'm going to keep saying that over and over and over as we talk about this book, because she is 16 years old and 26, maybe 27 at the end of the book. She's really young for most of this book, you know. She goes through some stuff. And on the very first page of the book, it's April 1861. You know, it's the first shots of the Civil War about to happen. And Melanie is 17. She's also very young. I mean, these are our female main characters, and they're children, you know, in my point of view. I think it's also interesting to remember that when Scarlett gets noticed by the county boys, the Tarleton twins say, you know, we find out they noticed her the year before when she was 15. So she's at 15 becoming you know, what in modern days would be like a sex object. She's becoming this young girl that men are noticing. And by the way, these men are a lot older than her. They've been to college. They've done their, you know, their European world tour, you know, and you know, they come back and they are attracted to this 15/16-year-old girl. It's a little creepy, you know, it's kind of creepy, but that's the context, that's the cultural context that we have with this book. Even Ashley references that his physical attraction started to her when she was very young. He references that, you know, he's been aware of her that way since she was in her early teens, you know. And Scarlett believes she fell in love with Ashley when she was 14 years old. And he had come back from after college, after 3 years of his grand tour of Europe. That's when she was 14 years old and she fell in love with him. So he's clearly in his 20s at this point. So, you know, this whole gender, male-female relationship stuff, it plays a bigger part in this story, in the book, than I think most people would recognize from having just seen the movie. When you have Vivian Leigh and, you know, Clark Gable and Olivia de Havilland and Leslie Howard playing these characters, and they all kind of look about the same age, you know? So you don't really get the sense of this age difference stuff when you see the movie as you do when you read the book. Rhett's in his 30s, by the way, I think, when he meets 16-year-old Scarlett at the Wilkes' barbecue. So that's really creepy.
Yeah, I think you do raise an excellent point that, yeah, it is important to remember that she's so young.
Yeah.
I think Gone with the Wind, like Andrew Lloyd Webber's Phantom of the Opera, if you don't realize how young the female lead is, you get a lot more annoyed.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, to me, because I fell in love with the book at such a young age, Scarlett was not, I had a lot more sympathy for her because, you know, when I'm reading the book, before I'd seen the movie, to me, she's a 16-year-old girl, right? I mean, I didn't have the visions of the movie yet, you know, because I'd read the book before I saw the movie. Now, I'd heard of the movie, obviously, but I hadn't actually seen it. So, you know, you get a 2.5-3 hour movie that gives you Vivian Leigh in your face, you know. I mean, you begin to see Scarlett as a grown-up adult. But if you read the book, and a lot of the time when she is being bratty, she really is a petulant child and a spoiled brat. Literally, she's a child. So it's kind of funny. But it is the story, for the most part, of her journey from childhood to adulthood, which is similar to this Jane Eyre also being a story about Jane's journey into a confident adulthood and self-actualization. I would say that Scarlett, as Margaret Mitchell's heroine, doesn't actually grow up that much in the book, let alone achieve any kind of confident adulthood or self-actualization. She goes through an awful lot, and yes, she advances as a businesswoman, she marries, she has children, she loses her parents, she loses her favorite child, which sounds terrible, but, you know, quote-unquote favorite child. All the things that we see in modern life as things that, you know, help people or force people to grow up. And, you know, the child within, in Scarlett O'Hara, just doesn't really grow up. She grows through those things, and she survives them, and it's ultimately a story of survival in that way. She survives them, but she doesn't, like, grow up the way we want to see bratty, spoiled, you know, petulant children grow up and become wonderful people. That just doesn't quite happen.
But she does grow partially.
Yeah,
I mean,
she does.
Near the end, when she recognizes what's good in Melanie, mm-hmm. I'm like, whoa, this is a major aha moment for Scarlett here.
It is, especially when you can't believe she hasn't had that moment before. I mean,
true.
If you read all the things those two women go through together, that it takes Melanie dying for Scarlett to realize this is her best friend, to make it as simple a statement as possible. This is her best friend who she's losing because Melanie's dying. It takes her dying for Scarlett to realize this. I mean, God, you know, it's so annoying, but it's all very well written.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But I love what Rhett says at the end of the story about Scarlett, because I think it's really indicative of who she is through the whole story. He says, "You'd had such a struggle, Scarlett. No one knew better than I what you'd gone through, and I wanted you to stop fighting and let me fight for you. I wanted you to play like a child, for you were a child, a brave, frightened, bullheaded child. I think you're still a child. No one but a child could be so headstrong and insensitive." And I think that's like Margaret Mitchell's voice coming through Rhett Butler, if you will, describing her character to us. And it's, like I said, it's at the end of the book. It's when Rhett's about to leave, and they've had their talk. Their cross purposes have been revealed. It's too little too late for Rhett. He's done. He's out of there, you know. But it's almost like Margaret Mitchell's apology of Scarlett, saying, "Look, I know you don't like her, dear reader, all that much. She's been a real pain, but think of her this way. See her the way Rhett sees her, and try to understand her through that, those eyes." And I think that helps. That helps me anyway. That helps me remember at the end of the book, when she's 26 years old, she's still, in so many ways, a child. This has been At the Roundtable with Alice
and Sarah E.
of Community Education Arts.
Our nonprofit organization is based in Noblesville, Indiana. You can find us online at cearts.org.
This activity made possible in part with support from the Indiana Arts Commission and the National Endowment for the Arts, a federal agency.
We'd like to thank James Weston for writing our intro music and for his technical savvy.
Join us next time
at the Roundtable.